Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order April 12, 2022. Let the record reflect the time is 3:35 p.m. Today we have President myself, Chair Schauer. We have Vice Chair Senator Reinbold online with us. We got Senator Holland, Senator Costello, Senator Kosaki. Please silence, turn off your cell phone. Staff with us today is in the rest from my office. We got Kerry with Senate Records, Talia with the LIO. We have six bills on the agenda for today. Senate Bill 215, Review and Reporting of Federal Receipts, Senate Bill 221, Changing RPL Process, Senate Bill 119, Oath of Office, Senate Bill 194, Allow Electronic Driver's License and ID, Senate Bill 195, Pay Increases for Exempt Employees, and House Bill 234, Political Contribution Limits. We're going to start up taking off, We're going to start off with Senate Bill 215 and Act relating to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, requiring state departments, agencies, municipalities, school districts, Native corporations, the University of Alaska, and other entities that receive state funds to report on federal receipts and relating to the increase of the appropriation item based on additional federal or program receipts by Senator Reinbold. We have received no amendments. We're going to ask, is this going to be Senator Reinbold or will it be you, Kelly, to come up to present? Senator Reinbold, can you hear me?
My line just got unmuted.
Ah, there you go. Now we can hear you. How do you hear me?
I can hear you great.
Awesome. Okay, so do you want to present and talk to this today, Senator, or you want your staff to do that here on the table?
I'm having a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, you're breaking up. We'll have Kelly come up and at least have both of you available as it goes. You're about 2x5 right now, if that's okay. Does that work for you at the moment? Okay, I'm going to say yes, so don't wait. So if you want to give us a top level again, Kelly, on 215, it has been heard last week. Like I said, no amendments received. I'd like to go ahead and give us that top-level overview, and then we'll go through comments or questions from committee members. So when you're ready.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Toth. I am staff to Senator Laura Reinbold. And this is the second hearing, as you said, of SB 215. Last week we went through the sectional, just a quick high-level overview. SB 215 is an act relating to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. It's also known as the Federal Receipts Fiscal Accountability Act. It requires the state departments, agencies, municipalities, school districts, Native corporations, the University of Alaska, and other entities that have received state funds to report on federal receipts and relating to the increase of an appropriation item based on additional federal or program receipts.
Okay, questions or comments from committee members at this time? Senator Costello.
Thank you. So do we know if other states require this type of reporting?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, yes, there are other states that do this, yes. And, in fact, I believe this was Senator Reinbold could speak more to the history of that.
Okay.
Senator Reinbold, do you want to add on?
Yes. In Utah is where we modeled the bill after, and I'm not sure Kelly brought it to committee or not, but that's where we got our information from. It was Elijah Bernhagen. This is actually the third session, we've been trying to get this bill through. And bottom line is a lot of federal receipts come into a lot of entities, and technically we're supposed to have appropriations powers over them, but a lot of them go outside of the legislature. So this basically allows us to see at a broader level what federal receipts do come into these entities so we can make better decisions with the budget. Also, it allows us that the people that are receiving these federal receipts, if there's a reduction of federal receipts, they have to have a plan in place, and that allows the legislature to be a lot wiser, because then everyone's not running to the state constantly for more money. And oftentimes when they receive these monies, there ends up being matching or grants and things like that, and it ends up putting a big strain on the state budget, and that's the purpose of the bill, transparency.
Okay. Senator Costello. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you for whoever wants to answer this. Just the first question is, you know, it relates to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, but the report is produced by the Office of Management and Budget. In Section 3 of the bill, these municipalities, state agencies, school districts, and corporations organized under 43 U.S.C. 1601 also submit the report to Office of Management and Budget. So I'm just asking, I guess the question is why you would have the delineation if we're just trying to keep this legislatively because legislature appropriates, why would it also go to the
executive? Mr. Chairman, I can answer that.
Go ahead, Senator Ramble.
The bottom line is when they do receive this grant money and these federal receipts, they have to report in already. They already have to report. And so the Office of Management and Budget is the logical place for them to go ahead and do the report. And but because the reporting is already done, it's just a good centralized location, and then send it over to Legislative Budget and Audit once the report, like we do on many, many reports.
Follow up.
And just a follow up is then has office. I don't have a fiscal note from the Office of Management and Budget on the executive side. Are they proposing any change in funding due to the extra potential workload?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I do not believe we got a fiscal note from Office of Management and Budget, but my staff could validate that.
I'm looking at it here, Kelly. You want to talk to that?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, I have not received a fiscal note for this bill.
Okay. It has been requested. I believe we haven't seen it either. Okay. Thank you. Follow-ups, Senator Kawasaki? Senator Kawasaki, go ahead.
Okay. I just had a question about compelling, and I think it's maybe not totally easy, but fairly easy for a municipality, definitely easy for a state agency, fairly easy for a school district and like the university, for instance, to get information regarding federal receipts. But how would you compel an Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act organization or entity to require those federal receipt reports?
Mr. Chairman, I can attempt to answer the question.
Go ahead.
I think anybody who's receiving federal dollars needs to be open and transparent with their accounting. And as Biddy has probably heard over the years, there has been some concern. And this is just one way to have some transparency. We're not reducing any or anything like that. We're simply just asking to see the books. And I think that is for fair and transparent government to increase public trust.
Kelly, go ahead.
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, also in Section 3, it does say that any other state entity that receives state funds shall prepare and submit the reporting to the Office of Management and Budget. So it is also tied to the state funding receipts.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Just a clarification then.
Sure. And just to add, I did get a clarification, zero fiscal note so far from staff should be up there. We'll make sure it's uploaded. But go ahead, Senator Kawasaki.
And then thanks for that clarification. Just a question then. When you say any other entity that receives state funds, what happens in the case of we know them as grants to other organizations through commerce, typically through a capital budget process. Would they also have to submit a report?
Do you want to try to answer that?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, as I understand the way this bill is written, is that any agency that receives the state funding, as it says in the title of the bill on line 2, page 1, it says departments, agencies, municipalities, school districts. So that includes any of those agencies that are receiving state funds and to report on the federal receipts.
So just to clarify, does that also mean it says and any other entity that receives state funds? So that would be pretty much all inclusive of any entity then. Okay. And then just a comment.
Go ahead.
Is that I appreciated the part about the municipalities that are population under 200 people to seek assistance from Commerce Department to be able to produce those reports because mm-hmm. they do take time. So I appreciate that it was put in there. Thank you.
Okay. Other comments or questions from committee members at this time? Okay. I'm going to take a brief of these. Senate State Affairs back on the record. Apologize for a momentary housekeeping item. We're going to go ahead and open up public testimony at this time on Senate Bill 215. Public testimony is now open. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? Seeing, hearing none. I do not see anybody online. Thank you, Talia. So we're going to go ahead and close public testimony at this time on Senate Bill 215. I'll give the sponsor one last chance here for any comments for the committee or the staff at this time. Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think, as you know, we've had times of abundance and we've had times where things go down. And I think it's very, very important for the legislature to understand the entities that depend on state dollars especially, and then they sometimes take federal dollars and it gets intertwined, and then the expectation is that we do matching. Bottom line is I think that we deserve a better budget process. I think our budget process is incredibly challenging right now. And this is just one way to improve transparency and helps anybody who's receiving state funding to basically be more open and transparent with us and then plan if there's any reductions in the future. So with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you once again for hearing this important bill.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to open it up to the committee members for last comments or questions. Seeing and hearing none, intent was to go ahead and move the bill today. Senator Holland, do you have a motion for the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate Bill 215 version 32-Lincoln Sierra 1517/alpha with attached fiscal notes, individual recommendations, and accompanying documents be moved out of Senate State Affairs and on to the next committee of referral.
Thank you. Does anybody object to moving the bill out of committee? Okay, seeing and hearing none, Senate Bill 215 passed from committee. We'll take a brief of these Senate paperwork. Senate State Affairs back on the record. We're going to move on, waiting for a member to show up for a bill and a briefing here in a moment. Moving on to Senate Bill 119 at this time. That's an act relating to oaths of office and requiring public officers to read the state constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the United States Constitution by Senator Reinbold. This is the first presentation of this bill, so we're going to ask Senator Reinbold and staff to come back up and present the bill. And as did you guys agree on which one based on the comms? Is she going to go ahead and brief it? Or okay.
I'm going to introduce.
Sounds good. So, Senator Reinbold, when you're ready, go ahead and put yourself on the record, and you can introduce the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. SB 119 requires legislators or anybody with an oath of, that takes an oath of office to actually read the Declaration of Independence, the United States Constitution, and the state constitution prior to being sworn in. What we learned when I was reading all the different statutes is a commissioner does it differently. You know, they take their oath differently than a senator or a legislator, and that wasn't uniform to a judge, and it was all over the map. And so basically what we wanted to do is just streamline it, and what we're doing is allowing the all the senators to make sure, and legislators, and anybody who is required in the Constitution to take an oath of office to make sure that they read the Declaration of Independence, the state constitution, the United States Constitution, and that it was all streamlined, and then it was filed on record. We've made adjustments. I think this is the third committee of referral already on this, and bottom line is they placed it where they're filed, like the municipal clerk takes it for the municipalities, the judges, there would be in the clerk's office, I believe, the judges, and then the office, the SLAMS takes the one for the state legislators. And Kelly can verify that I said that exactly correctly. So with that, that's just a very, very high level to ensure that people recognize what we're doing. I do believe that the Declaration of Independence got stripped out in judiciary, and I'm sure hoping to put an amendment back to put that back in there, because that is the framework of why we do everything we do in the Constitution. They're like hand in glove. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and I assume, Kelly, you're going to run us through sectional, and I know it's zero fiscal number. Go ahead, Senator Preston.
What version of the bill are you looking at?
It should be on version W right now, CS. Does everybody not have that?
I don't have that.
Do you have copies of it out there for everybody?
Mine has the declaration in it.
Okay, yeah, this is version W from Judiciary. We went backwards on this one. So we're going to take a brief at ease while we look for the paperwork. Senate State Affairs back in the record. Just a little housekeeping, make sure everybody had the right version of the bill. So that being said, Kelly, go ahead and take us through sectional and the fiscal notes, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kelly Toth, for the record, Senator, staff to Senator Laura Reinbold. This is the CS SB 119 Oath of Office. It's version W. And so this bill requires all of those who were statutorily or constitutionally required to take an oath in the state of Alaska to read the United States Constitution and the Constitution of the state of Alaska. Following the reading of the documents, a signed statement acknowledging the action will be filed with the Alaska State Libraries, Archives, and Museums directly after taking the oath of office. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, would you let me go through the sectional now?
Please.
Thank you. So Section 1, AS 1412090, is amended to require that school board members before taking office shall read the Constitution of the State of Alaska and the United States Constitution. Each section requires specific elected or appointed officials to read the documents. And then just as a high level with this sectional, to not read the entire sectional for brevity, Section 2 applies to the law enforcement officer. Section 3 applies to the Supreme Court justice. Section 4 applies to the Court of Appeals judge. Section 5 applies to the Superior Court judge. Section 6 applies to the District Court judge and the magistrates. Section 7 applies to the legislators. Section 8 applies to the municipal officials. Section 9 applies to the executive offices and board members. And Section 10 applies to the public officer or employee of the state.
Okay. Questions so far on the sectional analysis? Okay. I just wanted to mention the fiscal notes so it's on record. We don't have any.
I
all
do.
All 3-0.
All the fiscal notes, yes, are all 0, Mr. Chairman.
Just like to put that on the record. Thank you. Questions, comments from committee members at all at this point for staff? Go ahead, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the second time I got to see it. I think I saw it in education as well. We did remove the Declaration of Independence at the time because I wanted to keep it to what officials are actually sworn, you know, taking an oath to. And they don't take an oath to Declaration of Independence. It is great reading. But so just as a for instance, maybe I'm actually looking for it. I'm not seeing it this time. Just if you're a Supreme Court justice, how is that documented? Where does it say? And just the same thing, the judge of the court appeals. I see under for municipal employees, there's a process for where they document it at. But is it actually documented in here that it's going to be documented with the state library system? Am I missing that this time around?
Through the chair, Senator Holland, what I see here is in section 6 or section 3. I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to, but where it talks about the Supreme Court justice upon entering office shall, after reading the Constitution, take and subscribe to the oath of office required by all officers and further oath. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, and I just don't see the process there where the oath that's sworn and subscribed makes its way to the library system. I just don't know if I saw that in here. I don't know how I missed that when I saw it the first time. That's the only question I have at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Kelly?
I will have to get back with you on that answer. I think it's in there. I think it just says that anyone who takes the oath to the Constitution puts it on the archives at the State Archive Library.
Okay.
And I'll continue to look for it while. Maybe if the committee has other questions.
Obviously a question, see if we can get a more fidelity or higher fidelity in the answer, Senator Costello.
Oh, I just am not seeing that in the bill either.
Okay. So that'd be a good one to take back and see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other questions, comments at this time? Okay. That being said, without spending more time there with no further questions or comments at the moment, we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside. If anybody would have amendments for the bill, please get them to the office, my office, by close of business this Friday, April 15th, and we'll bring the bill back up at a later time for public testimony and amendments. Thank you. Thanks, Senator Reinbold. And we do have our guest in the back has arrived. So we're going to roll back up the calendar. Thank you. To Senate Bill 221. And next bill is going to be the committee substitute for Senate Bill 221, an act relating to appropriations of federal receipts and relating to an increase of an appropriation based on additional federal receipts by Senator Wilikowski. There were some amendments to this bill, and we will get to those here as we get started. But before we get moving, we're just going to ask again for just kind of a reintro on the bill for the committee and the public record, and then we'll entertain any comments or questions before we move on with the amendment. So, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage and Jaybird, joined by Sonny Kawasaki, my Chief of Staff. Apologize for not being here at the beginning of this. So, this bill seeks to fix an issue which I think we've really seen the effects of in the last couple of years with the revised ARP. Program legislative process. It's also known as the RPL process, which we believe is arguably unconstitutional in that it allows one individual, that being the governor, to appropriate funds without the full legislature having appropriated when the Constitution is very clear that the legislature is the appropriating body. This seeks to fix that, and happy to go into more details. We did work with your staff, Mr. Chair, to some amendments that I think address some of the concerns that the committee had, and happy to address those as you proceed.
Okay, and we'll just open it up to the committee for comments or questions before we get started with the amendment process. Anything from anyone at this time? Senator Costello?
So the amendments lack a sponsor. I was just wondering if, as you go through, you could mention who's introducing the amendment.
I'm going to do all of the amendments, but thank you. Yep, a little different today. And, okay, and Senator Rimbaud, just to make sure, since I know, I believe you're still there. Yep. Did you have any questions or comments? I want to make sure we don't miss you on mute if you were asking.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like this bill.
Okay, that's pretty succinct. Okay, so we're going to move on with the amendments and with myself and my vice chair to my right today. And we're going to start off with amendment number one. And it's going to be labeled I.1. I move amendment number one.
I object.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. And we're going to now defer to the staff. So you're going to go ahead and give us the briefing on each one, and we'll go through questions for them. So when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sonia Kawasaki, staff to Senator Bill Wilikowski. The First Amendment provides a title change to include the topic of the special session. At the last hearing, Senator Costello observed that the legislation addresses a change in law relating to special sessions, but the bill title did not reflect that subject as required under the Alaska Constitution. This was inadvertent, so Amendment 1 I.1 provides a title change to include the bill's applicability to special sessions. And thank you to Senator Costello for catching that error.
It was a good catch. I do remember that. Any questions, comments on Amendment number 1? Mr. Vice Chair, do you maintain your objection?
I withdraw.
Thank you. Are there any further objections to Amendment number 1? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment number 1 passes. We're going to move on this time to Amendment number 2. It's going to be labeled I.2. I move Amendment number 2.
I'll object for discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. When you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sonia Kawasaki, staff to Senator Wilikowski. Amendment I.2 establishes an immediate effective date. This amendment would provide for immediate effective date instead of the default when no effective date is provided for, which would result in an effective date 90 days from enactment. And I think that this was also an oversight on our part. I think we'd prefer to have an immediate effective date so that when the bill is enacted that it becomes law instead of waiting 90 days, in which case that the governor may submit RPLs that do not adhere to this process.
Okay, thank you. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you. In Section 4 of the bill deals with the applicability of the bill. So if appropriations were made, I guess I'm looking at this backwards. So it doesn't apply to appropriations that were increased before the effective date of the bill, but if it has an immediate effective date, I guess how does that sync? Is my question just really quickly.
For the record, Senator Kawasaki, staff to Senator Wilikowski, the applicability provision has to do with if the legislature passes an appropriations bill that doesn't adhere to the process that SB 221 will change the RPL process to, then the bill won't apply to the RPLs that are submitted based on the prior version of the RPL process. And to allay any concerns, I also discussed with legislative legal that as far as the incoming infrastructure funding that is federal, there's actually at least in the Senate version of the bill right now that's being heard in Senate Finance, there's a special provision in that operating budget in which the infrastructure funds won't be will not be covered under or permissibly covered under the RPO process. So I think if there were concerns on the infrastructure funding, that would be the infrastructure bill funding that would be addressed under that special provision in the operating budget.
That's interesting. I'm not aware of that. So I'll have to learn more about that one. Senator Kawasaki, follow up.
I don't have the operating or capital budgets in front of me, but so House Bill 281 has contingency language based in the, like, it's the last like two or three sections of the bill. So is that what you're saying, is that if the contingency languages are built in there, that sort of in case there's a issue related to the funding, the federal funding, that's, we're not sure whether we can use it or not. Is that the case then?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that is accurate. In essence, the Senate Finance CS for the operating budget reflects that as far as the RPO process, funding for various federal pockets of funds that are coming to Alaska, including the infrastructure funding bill, federal funding, will not be permissibly subject to the RPO process.
Thanks.
Okay. So just so if I'm following that means that we're passing this, even if it had an immediate effective date, these still won't fall under it because of the exceptions for now. Is that true?
Chair Schauer, that is correct.
Interesting. Right. Senator Costello?
So since the legislature can call itself into session at any time, is the idea that we would do that and avoid an RPL process and have more elected officials participate in the distribution of the of federal funding if needed?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, if you're speaking to the operating budget and the provisions of the operating budget, I mean, I am not certain, I think, of the intent of the legislature at this time or the Senate Finance Committee at this time with respect to infrastructure funding. I believe in the last hearing on the operating and capital budgets the capital budget, that there was discussion by the chairs and the members that the funding for infrastructure, federal infrastructure dollar projects, for capital projects would, certain projects would be included in the capital budget that has been introduced as a CS in Senate Finance this week and will be addressed soon in Senate Finance.
So, okay, good. So just so I'm following on, because we have the multiple budgets coming down, which would this then apply to any of the ones that we have to deal with now? Because I see the reason of the effective date and trying to make sure, but what would actually fall under this new version as opposed to what may not, based, because we're talking a lot of things here. Now I'm trying to track which one it would matter.
It's Mr. Chairman, Bill Lukowski, for the record, it's going to depend on timing. If this bill passes quickly and is signed into law by the governor, then before the budget's passed, then this bill would apply to any of the other subsequent budgets that pass. If this doesn't pass till after those budgets pass, then this doesn't apply. I should add, mostly Sonia has been working very diligently on amendments to the budget to try to include some language. I asked the administration if they would support tighter controls similar to what we're doing here to the RPL process in the budget, and they said they did not support that. So we'll see. I am running amendments, though.
Okay. Copy. Other questions, comments on amendment number 2? Okay, seeing and hearing none, Mr. Vice Chair, do you maintain your objection?
I'll withdraw my objection.
Are there any further objections to amendment number 2? Seeing and hearing none, amendment 2 passes. Okay, we're going to move on to amendment number 3, labeled I.4. We skipped the I.3. I'll move amendment number 3.
I object for explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, and Sonia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sonia Kawasaki, staff to Senator Wilkowski. Amendment I.4, which is Amendment 3 for the committee, permits a maximum funding for new appropriation items. Without this amendment, the bill suggests that the full legislature could only provide for an increase of an appropriation item in an enacted appropriation bill. The amendment would permit the legislature to provide for appropriation items not already included elsewhere in the budget, considered, quote, new appropriation items for which the funding may materialize. This amendment provides more flexibility and reflects the current practice of the legislative budgeting process under the budget section referencing permissible RPL spending, which for the current version of the operating budget being considered in the Senate Finance Committee appears to provide for open-ended authority.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Seeing and hearing none, Mr. Vice Chair, do you maintain your objection?
I withdraw.
And do we have any further objection to Amendment Number 3? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment Number 3 passes. Moving on to Amendment Number 4, labeled I.4, excuse me, sorry, I paid myself on that one, labeled I.5. I'll move Amendment Number 4.
I object for explanation.
Thank you. And Sonia, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sonia Kawasaki, staff to Senator Wilikowski. Amendment Number 4 adds other receipts in addition to federal receipts. This bill addresses federal receipts that the state may receive that the legislature did not include as known funding for budget items in an appropriation bill. Based on review of current and historic budgeting practices, this amendment is needed to re-add non-federal sources of funds. For example, there are several items in the current version of the operating budget, which are for state sources of additional receipts, such as additional funds collected by the Alaska Marine Highway System Fund, the Information Services Fund, the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trust, and receipts of the University of Alaska. This amendment would enable the legislature to provide for spending of those and other state sources of receipts through the RPL process, while at the same time establishing limits to that spending. So this amendment tracks the ability to do so that is in current RPL process that we are attempting to reform.
Okay. Questions for the sponsor? Okay. Won't belabor the point. Mr. Vice Chair, do you maintain your objection?
I withdraw my objection.
Any further objections to Amendment Number 4? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment Number 4 passes. We're going to move on.
Amendment Number 4, Amendment Number 3.
It's 4. How it's labeled. Right. Yep, skipped one. Thank you. We're going to move on to Amendment Number 5 at this time. It's labeled I.6. I'll move Amendment Number 5. Yeah.
I object for explanation.
I'm just going to ask sponsor. This is the last one we have, is I.6, correct? Okay, Number 5. Okay. Making sure we're tracking right. So you object?
I object.
Thank you. To Amendment Number 5, and we'll go to the sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sonia Kawasaki, staff to Senator Wilikowski. Amendment 5, which is labeled I.6, adds legislative budget and audit notice and comment requirements to the full legislature. At the last hearing, several members of this committee expressed a desire to provide the rest of the legislature an opportunity for input about RPL spending and not just to rely on the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee for review and approval of RPLs. This amendment addresses those members' concerns by requiring LBNA to provide the full legislature with notice and an opportunity for review and comment of the proposed RPL packages before LBNA may make any other recommendations to the governor. This amendment provides the full legislature with appropriate access to the process and an opportunity to voice concerns. And I appreciate the member's suggestion in this respect and hope that this amendment works for that purpose.
Yep, Senator Costello.
Thank you. And I thank you, Sonia, for the explanation. I'm not certain that this is clear enough. So on lines 6 and 7, it says notify the full legislature that
The revised program is available for review and comment. It's not clear by whom, and you could say by LBNA. So I was curious if you could just add by the full legislature.
Where would you add that again, Senator Costello?
After the word comment.
Comment. Okay. Could you read that one more time just so I'd know exactly how it was sound?
Notify the full legislature that the revised program is available for review and comment by the full legislature. Because otherwise it's not clear who that it sounds to me like, oh, that LBNA is just notifying the legislature that they are going to be reviewing the RPL.
Go ahead. Comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chairs. Thank you, Senator Costello. I would concur that probably would make this amendment more clear for that purpose.
Okay. Before we go further, were there other comments or questions to that? Yeah. Senator Kawasaki, go ahead.
General question or comment, because I served on LBNA for several years, and isn't it typical that we already do get notified when there is a current RPL? I don't know who else has sat on LBNA.
I don't know. Not me. Anyone? I think Senator Reinbold has. She's online.
I am online. Mr. Chairman, I actually like Senator Costello's amendment. I follow LBNA just because I want to. Before I was actually a member the last 2 years, and it was very difficult to find out about the RPL. I literally had to go to another member at that time, it was Representative Tuck, just to complain about the $1.2 billion of the COVID money getting distributed. And of course, the governor wanted to hold on to it. And I think it's completely unconstitutional, personally. And that's why I absolutely think adding this clarification is important. So with that, if we vote, I'm supporting it.
Okay. Does that answer your question? Okay. Senator Costello, you want to suggest a conceptual amendment to amendment number 5 and test my knowledge of being able to get through the English on this one?
Could we just take an at ease and I'll actually
absolutely
write it out?
Yep, at ease. Senate State Affairs back on the record. Mr. It's a weird sound. Okay, Senator Costello, I believe we have a
I move motion. Amendment 1 to Amendment I.6.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
It just adds by the full legislature after the word comment to make it clear that the review and comment is by everybody, not just LBD.
Okay. I have no questions. Other questions are from the committee members.
Does it have to be referred to as conceptual amendment 1, or once it's on paper, it's an amendment?
No, you're right. It's an amendment to the amendment.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay. No questions? Senator Reinbold, I think that was you.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to make sure it's not everyone. It's of the other legislators. If you could read the exact language, it would help me because I can't see it.
Good point. Thank you.
So the amendment is adding after the word comment on line 7 by the full legislature. So the review and the comment is by the full legislature.
You have it now.
Thank you. Yes, it's much clearer. Thank you.
I'll take a picture. And I'll
I did. It. She's got it. Okay. Are there any further comments or questions from committee members on the amendment to the amendment? Seeing and hearing none, I will remove my objection. Are there any further objections to the amendment to the amendment? Seeing and hearing none, the amendment to the amendment is accepted. So we're back to the amended version of amendment number 5. Are there further comments and questions from committee members on amendment number 5 now as amended? Okay, seeing and hearing none, Senator Holland, do you maintain your objection?
I withdraw my objection.
Okay, are there any further objections to the amended version of Amendment 5? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment 5 is adopted. That was to confirm with the sponsor the last amendment we had offered. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. All right. We have concluded the amendment process for Senate, the committee substitute for Senate Bill 221. Do committee members have further questions or comments for the bill sponsor or any at this time on the bill? Anyone? I'll give it the floor to you, Senator Wilkowski, if you have any final closing comments.
No, just thank you for the thoughtful process, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. And I know there was a question before, but based on the timeliness of this one and trying to know that things and a lot of money's coming, my intent was to move this today so that we could get this on hopefully to the next committee referral. So that is my plan, but I'll ask for that. Is there any objections to moving the bill at this time from committee members? Okay, Senator, that being said, Senator Holland, do you have a motion for the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that committee substitute for Senate Bill 221 version 32-LEMISERA-1472/I. As amended, with attached fiscal notes, individual recommendations, and accompanying documents, be moved out of Senate State Affairs and on to the next committee of referral.
Thank you. Anybody object to moving the bill out of committee today? Okay, seeing or hearing none, the committee substitute for Senate Bill 221 passes from committee. We'll go ahead and authorize Legislature to make any technical conforming changes at this time, and we'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Senate State Affairs is back on the record. And we're going to move on to Senate Bill 194, an act relating to electronic identification cards relating to electronic driver's licenses and permits. Relating to motor vehicle liability insurance and providing for an effective date, this is by Senator Kawasaki. We had received no amendments past deadline. This one, we're going to go ahead and take public testimony today and further questions and comments. Senator Kawasaki has indicated he's going to stay up here at the table, and we'll bring your staff up at this time. And we'll entertain questions or comments from the sponsor or committee members. If you could give us just the top level, again, just to reintroduce it to the committee and the public, please.
Of course, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Stuart Relay, staff to Senator Kawasaki. Thank you for hearing this bill again. SB 194 is an act relating to electronic identification cards, relating to electronic driver's licenses and permits, relating to motor vehicle liability insurance and providing for an effective date. And the top, a broad view of this bill is that it allows Alaskans to carry electronic versions of their IDs, driver's licenses, and learner's permits. It establishes a fee structure and amends the current fee structure for different physical licenses, and that's basically it. And I do have an answer to a question that Senator Holland asked in the previous hearing last Thursday, if the committee would like to hear that.
Please, go ahead.
Of course, Mr. Chairman, so last hearing, Senator Holland asked about the fees for electronic driver's licenses in other states, and to get that information, I reached out to NCSL, and they sent me a memo, which I shared with the committee ahead of the hearing today, they were able to find 8 states that do provide electronic driver's licenses, and just for the committee's information, those states are Alabama, Arizona, Colorado, Delaware, Georgia, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Utah. And of those states, they were able to find that the state of Oklahoma charges a yearly fee of $4.49 for electronic driver's licenses. And the state of Louisiana authorizes a $6 fee, but it does not appear they currently charge that $6 fee.
Thank you. Questions, comments from committee members at this time? I have one, and I apologize because I missed last week. I was on the committee for a while, but missed some of it in air travel. What would happen, for example, if you have, like, I know Real ID, a lot of people don't like it, but, you know, it is a thing unless you have, like, I have a military ID or something else that substitutes for that. You notice when you go up to the security, they'll scan it, look for colors and things. How would that work around, say, a federal requirement if you were at an airport and they want to look at your ID and be able to see and check the colors? There's almost like a watermark, et cetera, in it. How do you get around that, or how does that work?
So based on my understanding, Mr. Chairman, it would basically be a barcode wherein you can basically scan your phone, much like how you would scan a boarding pass, and from that they would basically be able to verify your identity, I believe. There are folks online from DMV that could potentially provide more information. I could be wrong about that.
Oh, Jeffrey is here as a lifeline if you need it. That's certainly true. So we'll defer to that. Jeffrey Smith from DMV director, if you heard the question, could you answer that? Or any other comments?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jeff Schmitz, and I am the director of Alaska DMV. With respect to the question regarding how it would work at TSA for Real ID, we expect that the process would be exactly the same as it is right now, and that the licensing and application requirements to obtain a Real ID are the same, and they will remain the same, whether or not it's an electronic format or if it's in a hard card format. So what occurs at the TSA booth is a scanning of the barcode of the information that's on the physical card right now, and that would also happen at the TSA lines when people go through and they show their electronic license.
Okay. Do you foresee any federal well, I don't know if hiccups is the right word. Is there any mismatch between the state requiring this and any requirements the federal government would have when you consider travel, especially if you go border travel international between country to country and what they would require? Is there anything that this would cause a problem for somebody if they just had this on their phone and they didn't have anything else as a picture? Anybody? I'm not sure who the best person to maybe take that one.
I'll just take a stab. I don't know the answer, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, we didn't really consider international travel, so I think that would be a question that we would have to find out. I will say that some of these states actually in the research from MCSL do mention they are Real ID, federal Real ID compliant, and others just don't note either way. So I know that there can be a compliance issue that we could deal through on this.
Okay. I'd be curious to get an answer to that just because I know some people don't have them or they're not going to get them, depending on what they have. And having do this a lot in my other job, it's you will often be asked for more than one form. Sometimes it's just passport. Sometimes they'll want to see something else. I'm lucky. Like I said, I can pull out a military ID, but not everybody could do that. So I'd be curious if that might put them into a place where they don't have that. Go ahead.
Can I add one thing to that, Mr. Chairman? Again, Stuart Relay staff to Senator Kawasaki. When we were originally researching this bill back in September, and we reached out to NCSL during that process as well, they let us know that the Department of Homeland Security is currently in the process of making rules about electronic real IDs and how they would be implemented for parts of Homeland the Department of Homeland Security, which would thus include TSA.
Okay. And then another question, just that maybe more local. I mean, it could be federal, but local or state. Has there been, have you reached out to law enforcement? Because the other one that you would typically do business with if you weren't traveling and looking at something like TSA across borders would be you get pulled over, you know, a law enforcement officer say, let me see your ID. You say, well, I don't have it. All I have is a picture. And I know they're getting more used to that, certainly like with insurance and other things now. But have you reached out to like Alaska State Troopers, other police departments to see what their take on this is? Are they okay with it? Do they have a problem with it? Where's that at?
Mr. Chairman, again, Stuart Relay, Staff Senator Kawasaki, we have not heard from the Department of Public Safety. We have not heard from law enforcement personnel.
I would like to see if we could get them to just ask that question. If there's a problem they see or something that they might want to see that would work better. I would imagine we're heading that direction anyways, but I would be curious to know what their take on that is, please.
I will get back to the committee with that.
Thank you. Senator Costello.
Thank you. So perhaps we just have somebody from law enforcement from one of the states that already is doing this to testify and let us know. I mean, if other states are doing it, then they probably are, you know, finding out what issues there are and if we can avoid them or make the bill better.
Yeah, concur. That's a good question. Yeah, that's a good point. Whoever, I'd just like to get a read from the ones that, you know, there are some things you're never really going to do business with your driver's license much, but it would be law enforcement or traveling, those kinds of things that you would typically have that. Banks and others aren't going to be looking for these things necessarily. That's it. You know, the institutions, you might have to pull out your ID. Those are the two that come to mind, off the top of my head at least. Other questions, comments?
We'll get back to the committee with that.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, comments at this time? Okay. I will we'll hold off for final comments. We're going to go ahead and get public testimony taken care of because we had not got to that yet on Senate Bill 194. So we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony at this time. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing and hearing none, I know we did have one online, but it shows unavailable. Is there anybody else that dropped off? Okay, so we did have one, but they are no longer there. So we're going to go ahead and close public testimony, this time on Senate Bill 194. Intent is to set it aside, get a few questions answered before we move on. But I'll open it up for sponsor staff or Senator Kawasaki if you have any further comments before we get this back before the committee. Okay, so at this time we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside. If there are any final amendments or if there's something that we need to fix, if you could try to get those before this coming Friday, April 15th, close business, that would be helpful, and we'll plan on bringing the bill back up at a future date. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And we're going to move on this time to Senate Bill 195 from Senator Keel, the local. And this is an act relating to the compensation of certain public officials, officers, and employees not covered by collective bargaining agreements and providing for an effective date. We have received no amendments at this time. We're going to take public testimony today, see where we are with that. But first thing we're going to do is go ahead and open it up to the sponsor If you'd like to give us, again, the top level, just to reintroduce everybody to what the topic is for the committee and the public, and any other comments you want to make at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jesse Keel, Senator from Senate District Q here in the Capital City. Glad to have you. Joined by my staff, Kathy Schlingheide. As a reminder to the committee and for the benefit of the public, Senate Bill 195 is the pay catch-up bill for those state employees who are not in a union. This lags the union pay schedule by one cycle. We all heard on the floor today, of course, that there's a new contract. That's not this. This is the last one. So this covers the exempt and partially exempt employees. Those would be, of course, most of the staff here at the Legislative Affairs Agency. It would be the entirety of the Department of Law, from the attorneys to the paralegals to the file clerks, just about everyone in the judicial branch of government, the bailiffs and clerks and staff attorneys, and then most of, although not all of, our state public corporations. So, Mr. Chairman, again, this is the pay catch-up bill, and it's just a basic matter of fairness to bring those employees along, albeit later than our union employees.
Thank you, Senator Keel. And do we have questions or comments for the sponsor at this time? Senator Keel, I have one just if you may have talked about this through the process, and I bring it up because in my other job, I am a union member, and so sometimes that's interesting because people see a certain letter before your name and just assume that you may or may not be. But that being said, one of the conversations that has been taking place is that union members have the power of, you know, a group that is negotiating with a company, for example, or an entity to have a contract, pay and benefits, et cetera. And the people that are not in the union or don't do that, they're on their own. They make their own contracts. That can work either way, right? I mean, if the union is doing better, more people will go to the union, less people will do their own thing. If the union is doing a terrible job, people might bail on the union and go make their own contracts and do better. There's at will. There's a lot of things at play. In the discussion, a constituent asked, and so I thought I'll pass it along in the conversation, what are your thoughts? And it may not even be possible because I don't know how the bargaining works for the state and how the different rules apply with the laws. It's not something I've personally looked at. What would, if somebody was to say, well, Senator Keel, why wouldn't you have individuals have their own contracts and try to bargain for a better pay scale, et cetera, as opposed to having the state do it? Now, like I said, that may not work, but I'm just curious if that's something you had brought up or not. And I'm kind of sort of passing this along from a constituent asked questions of why we would do this. Kind of be the collective bargaining for the non-union members as the legislature, as opposed to letting them negotiate their own contracts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an excellent question, and I am a great believer in and supporter of collective bargaining. The state of Alaska has for a very long time set a salary schedule for all our employees who are not in the union, and we set it by law. In fact, it's that law that Senate Bill 195 adjusts upward by a couple of percent a year. So we don't have never had the opportunity to look at that type of situation where each legislative staffer and each teleconference operator and each attorney at the Department of Law negotiates independently for their pay or their benefits. I think it's fair to say that the state of Alaska would probably need a significant investment in human resource specialists to do those negotiations. And so Senate Bill 195 does not propose a change in that. It does propose to bring those employees along. And again, I'll flag a cycle, bring their pay up to where the union employees have gotten to in the past.
Thank you for that. It helps to know that is in my own position, like I said, because it's not something I've investigated. Senator Kawasaki, you had a question or comment?
Yeah, just I guess question first and then a comment to that is that why do you think Legislative Affairs Agency and legislative employees have not entered a collective bargaining agreement?
Do you know if we've been at that under Mr. Chairman, I can't directly answer Senator Kawasaki's question as to why the legislature doesn't have its employees in union. I will give a little historical context from the third branch of government. once upon a memory, there was an adjustment to a pay schedule that did not provide the same adjustment to employees of the judicial branch of government as others had gotten. It was a particular step in the pay schedule. The employees of the judicial branch of government did, in fact, certify a union. And they organized and negotiated a contract that included that pay step. I can't tell you why that ended, but ever since then, I can tell you that every time we've adjusted the schedule, we have included them fully.
And then just to follow up. Yep. And then do you think that by doing this by state law and adding the 2.5% adjustments, do you think that softens a resolve of the legislative branch of actually organizing itself?
Mr. Chairman, it's a great question. And I just need to go back to the principle. I really do believe that employees are best suited under both federal labor law and under the Public Employee Relations Act that we have at the state of Alaska are best suited to decide whether they choose to be represented by a union or not. I'm not aware of any organizing efforts, that's not my decision as a legislator to make. So those employees have whatever choices the law allows them. And I would think that if someone were bound and determined and thought that that was a great idea, they would look at it's been almost a 3-year lag time on these pay adjustments and be pretty motivated just by that.
Thank you. Good. Other comments, questions? Okay. 10 now, we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony on Senate Bill 195. The testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing and hearing none, we do have one online, first one today. We have a Betsy Bull from Anchorage. Betsy, if you can hear me, go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name, who you represent, your location, and if you can give us 2 minutes of testimony, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Schauer and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Bull. I am from Anchorage. I'm here representing myself, and I would like to give testimony in support of Senate Bill 195. I'm a prosecutor in Anchorage, and I support Senate Bill 195 as a starting point, but I argue it doesn't go far enough to address the retention and recruitment problems that the Department of Law faces every day. By way of example, my colleague in Anchorage had 100 sex cases, including a couple of homicides. While she was here in Anchorage, she received and accepted an offer out of Washington State. That offer included a pension. It included a 20% salary increase. It included a yearly cost of living adjustment of 2.5%. It included a merit increase. It included equal paid time off plus sick leave. And it included compensation for all on-duty hours that she was required to have in addition to her regularly scheduled work. All of that came with 31 cases. She received all of these benefits, and it included a nearly 70 felony sex case load reduction. That's what the Department of Law is competing against. That's why we lose talented attorneys every single day. We aren't even competing. We aren't even on the same playing field at this point. When we lose these attorneys, other attorneys have to pick up their work. It's not just a law. It becomes a burden to all those who are left behind, wondering why they stay, why they work 60 hours a week when they're paid for 37 and a half. Why they continue this work when they haven't been given a cost of living increase in nearly 7 years. That's why SB 195 is a small step in the right direction. Every day we're asking our prosecutors and our attorneys in the Department of Law to do more with less. Last year alone, I carried over 100 sex and homicide cases. And by way of example, I calculated I was on duty 24/7 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 22 weeks out of the last year. That came with no compensation. We ask our attorneys to routinely work outside of their regularly scheduled hours. When they're in trial, they're often working 80 plus hours a week. We ask them to be on duty 24 hours a day with no additional compensation. With that duty comes the requirement that we advise detectives, that we advise members of our multidisciplinary teams on serious and complex cases. We're often in rooms advising on homicide cases after having been to the scene. And we're giving advice when everyone in the room, as their base salary, makes more than we do. They look to us to make these important decisions. And the detectives that we work with, their base salary is higher. Members of the teams that we work with, their base salary is higher. Our salary and the lack of cost of living increases over the last 5 to 7 years have made it so that we lag behind our colleagues significantly while we're being asked to do more. I calculated my work over the last couple of weeks.
Try to close it up for
me. I'm approaching 2 minutes.
We're actually about 4.5.
Oh, I apologize. I will leave it there, but I am for the committee to pass Senate Bill 195 and to recognize that it's a small step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Betsy, for calling in today and testifying. I don't see anyone else online, so we're going to go ahead and close public testimony on Senate Bill 195. Listen to that description. It sounds like a young enlisted Marine. You can talk about what they get paid and how much they work. And it's interesting. Been there. Okay. At this time, we're going to just open it up if you have any further comments for the moment. Mr. Bill Sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I thank you and the committee for the time you've spent on the bill and for considering it today. The one additional detail that came to my mind, there are some exempt employees who have a union. This bill does not apply to them, so that's worth noting as well.
Okay, and thank you, Senator Keel. So we're going to bring this bill back up shortly, and we'll clear you off for today. Thank you guys for coming out and waiting and being patient. Okay, we're on to the last bill for the day, and I do have we were able to get there. It was 10 minutes left. I wasn't sure how we'd do. I was hoping for that. So we're going to move on to House Bill 234, an act relating to political contributions relating to location of offices for the Alaska Public Offices Commission and the locations of which certain statements and reports filed with the commissioner made available by Representative Schrage. We're going to go ahead and take public testimony today. We're going to start with Representative Schrage and let you, as the bill sponsor and staff, if you have any updates or, again, that kind of top level, remind ourselves and the public what we're dealing with, and you have the floor.
Thank you, Chair Schauer. Really appreciate the opportunity to be back before your committee again today. Really do appreciate it. Looking forward to the public testimonies to the extent that there is some. Just on a very high level, I know we're tight on time, and I want to make sure that if there are folks that have called in, that they get an opportunity to voice their opinions. But just on a very high level, what House Bill 234 does is it fixes the now gaping hole in campaign finance that we have in the state of Alaska as a result of the federal court's decision to strike down a number of our limits, as well as the Alaska Public Offices Commission's decision not to accept their staff recommendation for temporary limits absent the legislature's action. So should we pass House Bill 234, we will reestablish campaign finance limits in Alaska, specifically and maybe most importantly for individuals to candidates, which as of right now, there are none, allowing for unlimited funds from outside interests to flow into our state, potentially harmfully influencing our elections and the public's confidence in our elected officials and our ability to represent them with integrity. So that's probably that is an oversimplification, but in the interest of time, I'm going to start there and see where the discussion leads us.
Thank you. And appreciate the top level. And we have staff obviously here. We do have Heather Hebden, the executive director of APOC, on board to ask questions. If we get to that point, we'll, like I normally do, we'll open it up to committee members this time for questions or comments. Senator Costello.
Thank you. So is currently, do independent expenditures, are they allowed to receive outside funding?
Yeah. Eric Gunderson, through the chair. Yes, independent expenditure groups are allowed to take donations from individuals in the lower 48.
Go ahead.
And are there any limits to that? I mean, I know that it's really, right now, that information's not even available to us, but are there limits to the outside contributions?
My understanding for independent expenditure groups, there are no limits. We do have Heather Hebden online who might be able to correct me if that's inaccurate, but my understanding is there are no limits.
Representative, you had an add-on?
Yes, I would like to just briefly maybe expand on that or opine on that just a little bit. There are no limits currently on what can be contributed from outside or just even from inside to independent expenditure groups. And frankly, I think that that's concerning. I wish that that wasn't the case. However, the Supreme Court has essentially established the fact that you cannot limit contributions to independent expenditure groups. Now, why that's the case for independent expenditures and not for contributions direct to candidates is because the Supreme Court has stated and established the fact that when you go through an intermediary, like an independent expenditure group, which does not coordinate with the campaign, that the risk of corruption or a corrupting influence as a result of that donation is greatly reduced. It's no longer, you know, business person A giving a $2,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 check to the candidate, which has a direct influence on that candidate. It's now giving it to a group which oftentimes spends that money on multiple campaigns in a detached fashion from that candidate. The candidate may not even be aware of who's contributing to that independent expenditure group, et cetera. And so that corrupting influence of that donation is mitigated through that intermediary. Now, again, I personally take issue with that. I think there is still a great concern, not only on a corruption basis, but also just a good governance and self-determination basis. I think all of those things are put at harm by the fact that we have unlimited contributions to independent expenditure groups. But to the extent that we as a legislature are able to act and ensure that we mitigate that corrupting influence on the individual direct to candidate, I think it's important that we as a legislature take that action. I hope that addresses your question.
Follow-up.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate the example, but just for the public listening, in Alaska, you know, candidates aren't getting $2,000, $3,000 checks from individuals. Our limit currently is, or prior to, you know, to this, had been $500. So, I mean, I see it as a freedom of speech issue. You know, if an outside or if an Alaskan can give to an IE and then that IE is influencing campaigns, then the freedom of speech, I think, from an individual should be should be looked at, the issue of freedom of speech.
And by, go ahead.
Well, I do have follow-up, but I want to make sure that committee members are able to get their questions on the record. So maybe I'll wait for just a second.
I was just going to have a follow-up question to her follow-up question. So when you say that, Senator Costello, do you mean in the sense of, you know, so an IE has unlimited, you would look at how you might have unlimited for an individual for the same reason with freedom of speech?
No, I'm just saying that we should consider that that freedom of speech is giving to a campaign and that on one hand we have an unlimited, there is no limit for an IE, but there is a limit for, you know, currently, and we're contemplating that in this bill. And I'm just making that point so that we can think about it.
The courts have certainly circled us around freedom of speech, of somebody being able to use their resources however they want without being limited. So that has certainly been a tenet of how the courts have handled this. I will add to the IE, I believe, although Heather, we can go to her in a minute if she wants to add any fidelity to this, but I think the top three and an IE have to be reported on, but that's the only ones as far as the top three donors. I believe that's what the rule is or the law. But if you want to further up, or we can go to Heather for any corrections so far.
Well, let's maybe go to Heather for corrections, and then I'd like to address the freedom of speech concern, which is very valid.
Okay. And we're losing Senator Holland. That's okay. We still have a quorum. That's okay. And hopefully, Senator Reinbold, are you still there? I think you are. But I'm not trying to forget about you, but it's weird when I have a legislator and I don't see them because you're – not on the screen today either. It's blank. Senator Reinbold, you still there? Okay. Well, we'll just keep moving in case here. So while we still have a quorum. So go ahead. Let's get to Heather. Heather, can you hear me? Did you hear those questions? And do you have anything you want to add?
Thank you. Chair Showers, are you able to hear me?
Loud and clear. Go ahead.
This is Heather Hebden, the Executive Director for the Alaska Public Offices Commission. And I'm not quite sure that I understood your question. I know that you mentioned the top three contributors. And while that is required to be disclosed in your identification for your political communications coming from an IE group, so your television, your radio, your flyers or mailers, they do all require the identification of the top three contributors. But these IE groups are required to disclose all of the money coming in and the money going out, just like another political action committee would be.
Go ahead.
But in terms of limitations on them, as Representative Schrage pointed out, based on the Supreme Court decisions and the court precedents, there is no limitation other than it can't come from a foreign national.
Chair Schauer, if I might ask a question of Heather Hebden just briefly. So we know that you're required to list the top three contributors in your campaign mailers and advertisements, radio commercials, et cetera. For donors to independent expenditure groups, can you please just again verify that the IE is required to report all of those individual donors? And can you also just remind me what the timeliness of those disclosures are? I believe it's either as a result of ballot measure 2 or maybe not, that there's a pretty quick turnaround on that disclosure. I don't recall the specifics.
Through the chair, Representative Schrage, yes, and you are correct. The contributors to an IE group would be required to file a statement of contributions. And I should clarify that this pertains to independent expenditures that are intended to influence a candidate election. And that was as a result of ballot measure 2. So they are required to report within 24 hours of making that contribution to the IE group, and the IE group is also required to disclose that within 24 hours of receiving the contribution. Under ballot measure 2, it requires true source reporting, so it gets rid of the vast majority of dark money in these candidate elections.
Before you do that, Heather, is what is left? You said the vast majority, but clearly not all dark money.
Chair Schauer, it really goes down to the definition of dark money. Essentially, let me refer to my definition. It applies to contributions in excess of $2,000 in the aggregate. So anything less than $2,000 wouldn't necessarily require true source reporting.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Schauer, may I address the freedom of speech concerns?
Before we do that real quick, because of time, I don't want to lose a quorum, is we do have, I want to open up and close public testimony, and there's somebody that's been waiting, so I don't want to lose them real quick. So why don't we get, if everybody's okay, we'll do that. So I still have Senator Reinbold to help keep a quorum for a moment. So we're going to open up public testimony this time as it was advertised, House Bill 234. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? It's always strange to say it when you're looking at an empty room. They're seeing and hearing none. We're going to go online. Kevin Morford, you have been very patient, and if you can hear me, go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name, who you represent, location. And if you could keep it to about 2 minutes or so, I'd appreciate it just for time. But please, you have the floor.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Showers and members of the committee, for taking up this important bill. My name is Kevin Morford, and I'm the president of Alaska Move to Amend. We are a nonprofit and nonpartisan group that works to strengthen the voices of ordinary voters in our political processes. I am testifying today in strong support of House Bill 234. It is not perfect, but this bill is the only one on this topic that has already passed the House and the only bill that has a reasonable chance of being sent to the governor this session. Both in initiative voting and in public polling, overwhelming majorities of Alaskans have expressed their support for reasonable limits on the size of donations to election campaigns. This support cuts across party lines. In 2006, 73% of Alaska voters voted to reenact strict limits on campaign donations. Polling shows that support remains strong today. The Alaska legislature should not allow three unelected judges to destroy these strong preferences of Alaskans. This issue was not raised as a matter of partisan political advantage. Candidates of any political party can have their campaigns overwhelmed by big donations to their opponents. We need an even playing field where the preferences of ordinary voters have the largest influence on our elections. In the absence of reasonable limits on campaign donations, the money of a very small number of very wealthy campaign donors with private vested interests can distort our elections. We want candidates to compete for the support of ordinary voters in their districts and not be corrupted by the siren call of big money from powerful economic interests. If this bill is not sent to the governor this session with a retroactive effective date, Alaskans will be subject to floods of big money donations from outside of Alaska. Please pass this important bill so Alaskans can retain control over their own political destinies. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, for calling in today and keeping it under 2 minutes, and I really appreciate your patience. I know you were online for a very long time. I don't see anybody else at this time online, so we're going to go ahead and close public testimony on House Bill 234, and I know you wanted to address the freedom of speech, but just I wanted to get that taken care of while we had it, so please go ahead.
Well, thank you for that, Chair Schauer. Appreciate getting public testimony in and not making people wait any longer than they otherwise have to. So returning to Senator Costello's concern about freedom of speech, I think that's a very legitimate concern, and the Supreme Court has articulated as such that political contributions are a form of free speech, and as a result, there's a very high bar in restricting free speech. That does not mean, however, that there is no reason not to restrict freedom of speech. We have many examples of that today, and we have examples of that in this bill as well. What the courts have said is that if you're going to limit free speech, again, you have to have a high justification. And the only justification that the courts will accept is to fight corruption. And I think that there is significant evidence through our state's history, as well as through much of the public testimony from prior elected officials entered into the court record, that there is a severe risk of undue influence on candidates, as well as a very high risk that there will be a public perception that even if that donation to candidate A, B, or C doesn't actually corrupt them and influence them, and it's not money for a political favor, that there is a public perception that if candidate A gets a $10,000 donation, that it's going to have an undue influence. And it's of the utmost importance that as a legislature, we maintain our integrity, not just actual integrity, but also the appearance of integrity, that the citizens of Alaska are able to continue having faith in our legislative body as an institution. I would also note that in response to the notion that, you know, we're not seeing $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 donations, we don't actually know that yet. The reporting in the state of Alaska for candidates is not like it is for independent expenditure groups where you have to report within 24 hours. We won't have another financial disclosure report for another couple of months. There may very well be candidates that have received very large donations already. We just wouldn't know it. I would also note that, you know, again, there is a restriction in restricting campaign contributions to freedom of speech. However, there is still an opportunity for someone to continue to advocate for their candidate of preference and continue to influence that election through those independent expenditure groups and through groups, PACs, et cetera, for them to continue to voice their opinion, have that freedom of speech, but to do so in a way that reduces that risk of either the actuality or the appearance of corruption. So all that is to say, it's a very genuine concern, and I think something that we all have to keep in the back of our mind. That when we establish contribution limits, we are indeed reducing or restricting the freedom of speech, but we do so for the very valid and justifiable reason of preventing corruption in our legislative body, which I think is of the utmost importance, especially at times like today. And I would also just note that I think that we're at incredible risk of that here in Alaska, where we have a fairly cheap media market and where we have seen the amount of money expended on political campaigns explode. I mean, just look at the most recent municipal election in Anchorage. The amount of money flowing into our state is tremendous, and I think that there is a very real concern that absent passage of House Bill 234, you will see candidates receiving donations of $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. We have examples of individuals making such donations to independent expenditure groups for the express purpose of influencing just a single election. If people are already willing to contribute $30,000 to an IE to influence an election, I see no reason that they wouldn't give $30,000 directly to that same candidate for the purpose of helping them win that election. The difference is when they give it direct to that candidate, there is a huge concern of corruption then introduced into that election environment. A long answer. I hope it addresses some of your concerns and add some of the color and context of how I think about this issue, because it is a very real concern, restricting freedom of speech, and one that I take to heart. I don't want to unduly restrict freedom of speech.
I find myself now being at immediate risk of being in trouble with staff here for going past without asking, because we're obviously there's still some things to work through with this. So I will just very quickly, any comments? Absolutely. Go ahead, Senator Kawasaki.
I mean, we can't be the only state that doesn't have a limit. I mean, there's limits in other states, right? I mean, I think it's fairly common to have a limit. The federal limit for a federal candidate for president or vice president is, I think it's 2,900 or something. So people keep asking for money until they get up to 2,900. And I'm like, I don't have that much money. Come on. But I know that some people do, right? So we can't be the state with unlimited contributions. There must be states with – sorry. There must be states that do have contribution limits now. And how do they get by with that?
Mm-hmm. Chair Schauer, Representative Schrage, for the record, yes, the vast majority of states do have contribution limits in place. There are a couple that don't. However, those are some fairly unique states, and I would also note that the media markets in those states are much more expensive than they are in Alaska, where $10,000 there will not go nearly as far as it would in Alaska. So I think that there's a significant difference there. With respect to how those other states get away with having contribution limits in place, well, they have contribution limits that look like those introduced in House Bill 234. They're typically per election instead of per year. They are higher than what we had in the past, more similar to what House Bill 234 has, where it's in House Bill 234, $2,000 per campaign, significantly elevated beyond the $500 per year limit that we had previously. In fact, in evaluating the constitutionality of a contribution limit, there is a test that the courts have looked at. It's the five-factor Randall test. And one of those warning signs, actually backing up before the five-factor Randall test, the danger signs that the Supreme Court spoke about when evaluating our prior contribution limits was that one of the danger signs was that our limit was lower than the lowest limit that they had previously upheld in the courts, which adjusted for inflation today is about $1,000 per year. So there's a way that the courts look at evaluating whether or not a limit is constitutional. On the very highest level, they look at, is it lower than what we've previously upheld as being constitutionally valid? And then there are some other factors that they look at as well, which I'm happy to run through, but I know we're short on time, so I'm just going to leave my answer there to see if that adequately addresses your question.
It did. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And hold those. And I think it would probably be good to have for the public record, maybe, and that's a great question, is what other states, you know, there's, I'm sure somebody, NCSL or somebody tracks that. To have that data presented to the committee, I think would be helpful to know who's doing what and how much and how they're doing and any of those. That data is usually pretty helpful. So if you get that, I think.
And Schauer, I do have just a very short paragraph that gives some context on national limits that was put together by the NCSL. Would you like me to read that into the record quickly?
Hey, what we're going to do, we'll hold that and read it on the next one. Just because I said I'm going past and I didn't ask for that. So go ahead, Senator Costello.
Thank you, and I appreciate your offer to give us that information. I'd be curious, too, to find out what if there are limits on independent expenditure groups, because, I mean, I appreciate everything that was said about not unduly influencing, you know, a candidate, and the fact that if you can give your money to an IE and then there's no appearance of corruption, but the IE can amass a tremendous amount of money, and then the candidate is faced with having to defend him or herself against the what the IE is actually saying about that particular candidate, either through direct mail to the constituents or things like that. So I see the IEs as having, you know, a lot of influence in campaigns, and then they're essentially appealing to their donors, and then they have a few folks who are sending out, you know, the mailers. And so I'd like to know what other states do in regards to the IEs, if there's limits there.
It's an interesting question as well, because one of the concerns I have, which we'll continue to debate, is the level playing field. I asked some questions when we talked about it last time. There are some at least perceived, if not real, imbalances in who gets what advantage from which group and how those play out. And how do we ultimately make sure that not only is it right and just, but also fair, so that one group or entities aren't getting an advantage. And that's a great question of how would somebody do that against an IE that could have unlimited pockets and you're stuck with whatever the limit might be as an individual. That's a tough, and that has happened. So those are good questions to ponder here. All right. That being said, I'm going to go ahead and stop just because of time today. And I beg forgiveness and thank the staff for being willing to stop or stay a little late without even asking. And that's my bad. But we'll set the bill aside to bring it back up at a future date. That's going to conclude our business. Senate State Affairs, due to Manning, is not going to be held this Thursday, April 15th. The next meeting will be next Tuesday, April 19th, 2022 at 3:30 p.m. back here. Seeing no other business for the committee, we're going to adjourn at 5:13 p.m. Thanks.